Welcome to the Digitally Sick podcast.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Digitally Sick. Thanks for listening in, as always. I'm Alex Butler from Foundry 3, and with me is my trusted partner, as always, Faisal. Faisal, how are you doing?
Yeah, all good. How's everyone?
Good. It's the usual level of laid-back enthusiasm, which I love. So we've got a really interesting pod, hopefully, for you today, with some really interesting people. And it's a big, busy pod, so hopefully my skills of hosting will be up to the challenge. And the first person I'm going to introduce is someone that's been on the pod before, Dave Hunt. And he's representing with his kind of group, team, whatever, he'll tell you what the right term is, of people from Health Reconsidered, which is essentially a thought leadership group of multiple different chats that go on during the week based on Clubhouse. I've seen a number of people listening will already be using Clubhouse. Dave, how are you doing? Good to speak to you again.
Yeah, great to be here, Alex. Looking forward to chatting to you guys again, 100%.
Yeah, it's going to be cool. Would you mind introducing some of the people that we have on the pod?
I mean, I use the term friends, is how we talk about it. So it's some of the team from Health Reconsidered. Mm-hmm. Health Reconsidered, as you mentioned, it's a global community. People from all across society, all across health, different angles, different perspectives, meeting on a daily basis to debate it. And I'm joined today by Kelly, who leads the Monday session called The Opt-In, which talks about diversity and inclusivity. And then also Christine, who leads the discussion on Thursday, which is the patient's perspective. And then we also have an incredible friend of ours who needs no introduction, which is Daniel Kraft. Daniel's been at the forefront of scientific and medical discovery and technology. He was the driving force behind exponential medicine and has got incredible ideas of where that's going to go in the future as it's been rebooted. And in his recent TED talk, I think he racked up 1 million views in something like a record time, talking about the future of medicine and how it's been affected by the pandemic. So hopefully some really interesting points of view for you today, Alex.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much. And yeah, it is an honour, Daniel, to have you on the pod. So thanks very much for joining us. 1 million views, that's very impressive. I actually did a TEDMed now 10 years ago, and it's kind of not going to mention how many views mine got because it's probably a bit embarrassing in comparison. But thank you for coming on. I suppose what we have here, rather than me trying to ask you really, you know, kind of clever questions, I just ask a kind of obvious question based on what's happened to us all over the past 18 months, 2 years. And that's, you know, with your hat on of looking at digital health, which I know you're a thought leader on, what do you think the COVID pandemic has done to medicine and done to, kind of the acceleration, if you think it has, of digital health, telemedicine technologies, telehealth? What do you think we're going through at the moment?
Sure. Well, great to be with you. I'm sorry I'm the only one without a cool British accent, even though I was born in London. So I'd say that the pandemic has been the best of times and the worst of times. Obviously, we're still in the worst of times instead of our speaking here in August of 2021. We're 18 plus months into it. In many cases, the fourth wave, kind of still a bit of a wave of the unvaccinated. And still part of an infodemic in terms of some of the overwhelming information for clinicians, patients, sometimes good information, sometimes bad being disseminated. But I'd say, you know, in terms of the best of times, it's been a bit of a forcing function, right? We have so many elements of healthcare around the world that are still quite broken. We're still using fax machines. We're still using paper forms. We still have waiting rooms. We still are doing one size fits all medicine and are often slow to collaborate and innovate. And, just like Sputnik sparked off the space age, COVID is a bit of a spark and a catalyst for a new health age, particularly, of course, in digital health and medicine. And you can look at that across whole different spectrums, you know, of course, on the sort of side of how we practice care, that had to shift pretty quickly, particularly in spring of 2020. Telemedicine, which is not new, obviously was accelerated partly through the relaxation of regulations, how we now can Zoom and talk to our doctor or nurse, and the payment models, at least in the US, went along with that. So that really shifted everyone's ability to have interactions outside the usual clinical space. We also had a whole shift in the way we would approach diagnostics. One of the key issues and still problem in the setting of pandemic is how we do testing in smart public health, which is many broken elements. We saw a lot of innovation on the testing space. It took quite a while, but now we do have low cost testing methods as test cards that are cost less than $10, take only 15 minutes, fast, frequent, cheap, and easy. In fact, part of my role this past year was chairing the XPRIZE Pandemic Alliance Task Force. We actually ran a 6-minute XPRIZE to get fast, better, cheaper tests. And that brought in 700 teams from 77 countries. And those platforms which emerged will not just be for COVID in the future, but for other infectious diseases and potentially non-infectious diseases. So kind of blending diagnostics, telemedicine, digital passports are sort of hoping connecting the dots between the often intermittent reactive data that gives us a sicker system to one that hopefully is going to bring us faster to an age of digital connected, personalized, not just data driven, but insights and actionable information based care. So those are a couple pieces. And of course, mRNA type vaccines and others were accelerated to clinic. The way we can do virtualized clinical trials has accelerated as well. And all those will hopefully maintain post pandemic and help us even identify and prevent future ones before they kind of hit us in a bad way.
Wow, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to take in. I mean, one of the things that we did quite a lot of work looking at people's just conversations within the social environment. And of course, obviously, what came through is what you said, which is, some of the rate regulatory reimbursement blocks, disappeared. And people had to accelerate what they were doing because there was no other choice. But there's a couple of things I was interested in asking you about it, because on the one hand, take an area like neuroscience or MS, what was interesting is that the patients were talking about having a more human experience with their physician than they actually were when they used to see them face to face. Because they said, for example, that they'd often just look at their computer a lot, or they wouldn't feel that they had their full attention. Some of the healthcare professionals in the space, some of the neurologists were saying that it was really interesting to get an insight into where someone's living and how they're living and to see them in their own environment. And I think there's a lot of kind of make do going on, which may be an English phrase, I don't know, but using an ice cube, making sure a carer is there to use a torch to do examinations. But where they said that it was obvious there wasn't so much was the capacity to do high quality clinical examination, for instance, remotely. And like you say, telemedicine's been here for a long time, and there's been a lot of keynotes and hyperbole and hype around the capacity to diagnose, measure, monitor, examine patients remotely. But for them, they realized that there really weren't many things there. Do you think there is a lack there, or do you think it's actually a lack of knowledge of tools and services that exist, rather than actually being a lack of innovation in that space?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just trying to connect the dots, which, connected blood pressure cuffs or even digital stethoscopes or digital otoscopes. It's now, again, partly catalyzed by the pandemic, that you can, exactly as you mentioned, see someone in their home environment, not just see them on the screen, but enable them to do self-exams. The platforms like TytoCare and others, LiveCore to do an EKG, sort of the era of, medical tricorders are arriving, where we're going to sort of blend, hospital to home or hospital to hospital, where a lot of care is really based on our, continuous data, whether it's for a complex autoimmune disease or an acute infection. So now we can, do a lot of the key monitoring with a simple pulse oximeter, whether it's connected or not, and a connected app gives sometimes not just the ability to do the telemedicine visit, but that in between, not just continuous data, but sometimes digital empathy that can come from the clinician, a check-in by chat, even if it's automated by a bot, makes the patient and the family and the caregivers more integrated. And of course, care is social. We can then help identify the caregivers and the environment, whether it's family, neighbors, that can help across the spectrum. And we've seen the big challenges and disparate social determinant elements that have been highlighted and that need to be addressed as well. So I think all those dots don't create new invention. It needs the alignment of incentives, the alignments of platforms that can work, reimbursement models, regulatory. And, that's been accelerated in some good ways. And hopefully, a lot of the innovations, and there's lots of new apps and tools and diagnostics and therapies that are coming along, which, again, will help monitor and manage this pandemic, but follow through and not just trickle down, but accelerate everything from, cancer care to, autoimmune disease. And of course, a lot of these diseases are complex, just like, there's no one size fits all, COVID infection. we're going to see the ability to take all this new data and turn it into more actionable insights that the patient can use and be empowered with, as well as the clinician, the pharma company, clinical trialists, and beyond.
Yeah, it was interesting you mentioned oncology, because there was a really highly followed patient advocate within lung cancer saying that, of course, mostly the pandemic has been bad, of course, as it would be for people, especially vulnerable patients like that, but that she saw a massive acceleration with regard to, access to information about clinical trials, virtual clinical trials, or clinical trials, run basically from a remote perspective, different types of relationship with regard to that, what you were saying, really, which is an ongoing kind of virtual or remote relationship with their care team, as opposed to, maybe kind of more deeper dive, more but more spaced out interaction. So do you see that as the model going forward then in an ideal world, which would be that obviously we're never trying to replace, an interaction between a healthcare professional and a patient in real life, but that actually we're going to be using technology to just fundamentally augment the current healthcare process.
But particularly with cancer care, I'm an oncologist by background, hematology, oncology, bone marrow transplant, and these patient journeys are very complex. And I think what we're seeing, number one, obviously the pandemic slowed down screenings, whether it's a mammogram or colonoscopies, et cetera. But we have seen some new innovations in, again, connecting the dots on the patient journey. It could be, crowdsourcing information, platforms like Stuff That Works out of Israel allows patients to share, it's kind of like a patients like me on steroids, share what's worked for your disease and help learn from other patients, all the way to sort of simple platforms like MedQuarter, which enables patients to, record and using NLP transcribe their visits with their oncologist or rheumatologist and share those with friends and family. And particularly in oncology journeys, there's lots of elements from diagnostics, to pathology, scheduling visits, chemotherapy, to radiation, to mental health. And I think we can start to kind of bring us that sort of Waze or Google Maps for healthcare, where patients will find, lessons from others who've been on similar journeys, and we can make the stress and strain of care, which often is, not the actual drug or therapy or visit, but all the in-between elements and uncertainty and education that can be delivered in a way that matches the patient and their family's age, culture, personality, and socioeconomic status. So lots of potential there, particularly in cancer. And of course, we're overlapping that with new omics, the advent of, blood-based diagnostics for early screening, like Grail just came out with. Lots of new technology coming to bear, and the ability to understand almost every cancer at the molecular level is really going to shift how we do everything, not just for immunotherapy, but to best understand who needs what therapy and when and how.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. I think there's a couple of points that are probably going to be taken up later when we talk about, for example, from the patient perspective. One of the things that I do find interesting is that I've noticed a switch from a pharma perspective on this to a desire to talk about access for more diverse populations. So access into people maybe from lower socioeconomic groups, people from other minorities, or people that have struggled to access the best care, and an idea that these types of technologies should be able to support an improvement in that. Obviously, the perception a lot of the time is that actually it's your maybe more affluent, maybe more highly educated, patient person who is actually more likely to even experience the benefits of augmenting their current care. Do you think there is a genuine hope that these types of technologies will actually improve access to care? For the larger populations, or do you think that's a bit of a way off at the moment?
No, 100%. I think, we really are at the cusp of truly democratizing many elements of care, whether it's, simple primary care all the way to cancer care. And, you can think even the poorest on the planet almost all have SMS phones. The planet right now, half the planet has internet access now, but that's going to reach 90%, 100% soon with platforms like Starlink and other satellite-based internets at 5G and beyond. And I often like to think not just about the social determinants of health, but the digital determinants of health. Does that patient have a smartphone or tablet or high-speed internet access, whether it's for educating their kids on Zoom school or being able to share their clinical data or talk to a chatbot? And I think, part of the challenge with digital health is often it's a bit one size fits all. I'm speaking to you from Silicon Valley. We might think everyone, drives a Tesla and has an iPhone. But if we can blend not just always the technology, but the user interface to match their education level, culture, even their incentives, might be points or social or dollars to get them to nudge their behavior or to stay engaged with their care, that can go a long way. And so I think the potential for, with your pharma company, device company, building a digital therapeutic is now you can access you know, in many ways, yes, there's regulatory barriers, but almost anybody on the planet with internet connection can connect, you know, not just the digital element, but connect that to therapeutics to help with AI-based diagnostics and therapy. We can upskill a community health worker. I mean, plenty of need now to enable, you know, diagnostics anywhere and therapy anywhere, whether it's delivered by drone or by chatbot. So lots of potential there. Part of the challenge though is in this age is there's so much already available, a lot more coming. It's confusing for clinicians and payers and healthcare systems to make sense of. I'm just relaunching the next version of this platform called digital.health. That's the domain, digital.health, easy to find. We're building a bit of a platform, including a digital health formulary, so you can match the solutions that already exist to a particular patient and eventually sort of prescribe them that tool, that app, that drug, device, or other combination that already has evidence behind it that matches their need. Because like all medicine, we want precision, personalized care, not one size fits all.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you. Well, I've realized I've been hogging the conversation with you. So Feist, was there anything you wanted to ask or chat to Daniel about?
No, I think it's more of a chat with everyone as well. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, we've been talking on the pod about all these technology that needs to change and help patients, but I think no one's talking about it from the user perspective, is how easy this is a technology for a 60-year-old to use. Do you see what I mean? Who's used to having a Nokia phone versus an iPhone, or had a BlackBerry and still using their BlackBerry if they're still allowed to. Do you see what I mean? It's the technology's great, but how do we help the users a lot more, I think?
And that's really, you know, the kind of purpose of Health Reconsidered and the global community we've kind of looked to build with people from, you know, say across the world and across healthcare. Mm. And it's the idea of trying to connect Daniel Kraft with, you know, someone, you know, fighting with, you know, a different challenge in a different part of the world and trying to overcome that information equality, drive that discussion. And for me, it'll be great to hear more from Daniel when he joins us on, you know, the 10th of September, Health Reconsidered Live, and we can hear from Daniel and Professor Shafi Ahmed and Jane Metcalf and Jason Sperling. And it all comes back to that thing that Daniel's trying to talk about, which is this blend of hospital to home and this idea of the augmented sort of healthcare system, but making sure that when we think about that, you know, for example, the patient voice is very, very active. And that's some of the things that Christine talks about with her room on the Thursday.
Perfect. Yeah, I mean, and even little things like, I know we always, obviously the West is always leading the way forward, but, and testing products and stuff, should the silicon companies who are creating all these digital, amazing digital health tools, take it to Asia first or third world countries and test it? Do you see what I mean? It's like we're testing it on the most, do you see what I mean, rich population versus the poorest population with less technology available to them.
And that's the discussions we're having. As say, you know, Christine has some of the most incredible people come into a session on a Thursday, and hearing their different points of view around the world is brilliant, and be interesting to hear them, Christine, react to, you know, the opportunities that Daniel's describing.
Well, it's interesting. Thanks, David, for bringing me in. But I wanted to say that, so I've been running the rooms now, or we've been on it, 5 months? And really, it started out as kind of just a small thing that maybe was going to continue and maybe not. And I apologize for the loud pounding above me. I'm in an apartment. But really, what I've found from just the room is that we've built these relationships and a place where people from all silos and all aspects of the industry can come and have a real conversation. And for me as a patient, it's been one of those series of unfortunate events, right? Everything that could go wrong did. But I've exposed myself to every different area of this industry, and I see conversations happening. I'm also in Silicon Valley, born and raised here. And I see a lot of conversations happening with amazing companies that have the potential to do things. And I see amazing things happening on the pharma side, but there's a very huge disconnect, and not just from the patient community, from each other. And so really, this has been an amazing opportunity on Health Reconsidered to bring together these different minds in a fun way. I open my show, and actually every show in the morning, 10 minutes early before everybody gets in, because I want to get to know our audience. And I find out about their families, what they're working on, and it just brings us closer. And I think it's that collective intelligence and the collaborative leadership that are going to bring viable solutions for us all. I see problems in the digital health space as a patient. I went into heart failure during the pandemic, 8 ER visits, 15 plus telehealth. But me and a lot of my community, we need doctors who are still going to touch us and feel us. And I have an amazing physician. When I went into heart failure, Dr. Eldrin Lewis, he's the head of cardiology at Stanford. He stepped in as my cardiologist and now friend. And we've really just built a relationship. First physician in a long time to look at my records and say, Christine, there's a lot there and I want to get to know you. And so for me, the importance is really there on forging those relationships where we can openly talk about the issues, because I see technologies developed here that are being smashed over here, or ideas that can come together and really thrive, but we work in our silos and we don't look at the full picture. So I think the digital technologies and innovation are needed, but we can't lose fact and lose sight of the fact that there are people behind this and they still need a little bit of TLC.
Mm, that's really, well, absolutely. The humanity side of things is something that comes out a lot, doesn't it, in these discussions. I mean, on the diversity front and the, I suppose, the access, equality and diversity, because I know there were some really good points made about how this can work. And I think Faisal was saying that, you know, there are pilots and there are examples of great work done in this space to try and make this, to democratize health in the way that Daniel described. So you have eye exams in remote parts of Sri Lanka that keep people from going blind, or, you know, there's whole loads of different programs about accessing different specific communities through digital health programs and pilots. And for example, there's simple things like triage in Malawi for malaria, where you, to the point Daniel made about training people remotely, training untrained health workers to be triaged to basically literally save children's lives in Malawi. But Kelly, I know that it's what you focus on in your room. What's the discussion in there, and what's your perspective on how some of this stuff can actually genuinely at scale access people better?
Sure. Thank you. My name's Kelly, and I'm co-founder of The Opt-In. I am white with another long list of other privileges, such as being cis, hetero, Christian, you know, all the things. Very privileged upbringing, very wealthy. And so my partner in The Opt-In and in our room on Mondays is Aurora Archer, who's an Afro-Latina. She's currently moving her son into college, or she'd be here. But we really focused on centering race equity into the conversation wherever we are, especially in health, without shame and with accountability. And so we do look into all these aspects, because when we're talking about diversity and we're talking about inclusion, it's diverse to what and included with whom? And sort of looking at, you know, when we talk about struggling to access and, you know, people who are affluent or highly educated, and seeing how people are structurally disadvantaged in our society and what identities are advantaged, and really unpacking those identities more as far as, you know, how they're advantaged. So people have better learning, better education, especially me as a white person. I mean, a lot of white people last year in Freedom Summer really kind of got a wake up call, and we're like, wait a minute, things are not what I thought they were. And so we are constantly unpacking and learning and inviting white people especially into the conversation. And we brought on Bob Allen and Matt McNally of Dentsu and Jennifer Blundell and lots of thought leaders in all aspects of justice work and health, to really center race equity in the conversation, if that is making sense.
Yeah. No, it does. Faisal, do you want
to... I was just about to say, how's that going for you?
Yeah.
I mean, has there been any change? We've got the same issues. I mean, if you go to London, you one part of the street is, I mean, the death rate's totally different to the other part of the street, which is a much, much richer area. So we've sort of got those problems, but in your chats, is there any solutions? Is there anything exciting people are talking about that can help change things?
Oh, that's a great question. We've brought on people who are part of organizations that we might not be as familiar with. So we have Kevin Epler on there, who's co-founded White Men for Racial Justice. And in the US, that's who holds the advantaged identities. So it's really a group who's working on education and changing their businesses and their companies to be more equitable and to educate their people better. So it's a journey. This is not a one and done. There is no quick fix. It took us 400 years to get here in the US, and so we're not gonna out of there today. But if we're not having a conversation and we're not naming the problems, then we're really not getting anywhere close to being in the right direction. So for us, it's a matter of, we can all have different thoughts, but if we are all headed in the same direction, meaning we all want to value all identities equally across the board, all social identities, then we're going to end up in a better spot than we were.
And what do you think from a practical perspective? Because, I don't feel I have any expertise to talk about the subject in itself. But one of the things that I always notice is that, there's a lot of theory and keynotes and goodwill and good intention. But a lot of the time it comes down to companies with governments and health providers actually doing something to reach out to specific communities. I mean, for example, a long time ago, I was involved in trying to help a very specific group of people from Africa within HIV, and there was ways we could target them through Spotify. And then once we did, we could give them tools and services to help them access care. Obviously, it's much more complex than I can do in a few seconds. But the point is that we can do this. We can get tools and services. If we can give people access, we can support them. But a lot of the time, in truth, that isn't done. And so I just wondered, because obviously there's a lot of people talking about this, and mostly because they're good people and they care. But is there any examples from what has been discussed of things actually happening to make a difference?
Sure. It's really coming from where we come from the opt-in, is this is a journey of change that starts internally to create external change. So as we know, systems are made of individuals. And if we don't change as individuals, we're never going to change the systems. So we really start with a basis of self-awareness and understanding where we see a hierarchy of human value in ourselves, and then how that bleeds out into our teams, into our companies. We become more racially literate. So as a white person, I was really, really racially illiterate. I really did not fully understand the consequences of our history and what it was in completion. To cross-racial connection and being able to have diverse teams and being able to navigate and have higher levels of racial self-awareness, especially as a white person, understanding my race and how it operates in a room, to stamina, which is really staying in it. It's really easy for me to be privileged and just go back to sleep. And so how do you stay in it and keep working when things feel really hard and really difficult? Mm-hmm. So that's just a little bit about us, but I don't want to monopolize the show. We could go on and on.
No, thank you very much, Kez. Really appreciate it. I've got a question. It might be a bit not contentious, but I'd be genuinely interested in whoever wants to take this up. Is that one of the things we speak about in the pod a lot is, and having done this for a long time, and particularly in a lot of the work that I do, which is basically to track and landscape digital health. And we've been doing it now for a long time, well over a decade. And there's always a pattern of what we kind of term keynote disease, where numerous initiatives are launched to great hyperbole. They get incorporated in lots of people's keynote presentations, like the Novartis contact lens, for example, which was never going to happen. And essentially, it's just one long round of that, of a kind of massively shortened hype cycle. But no one ever follows up to find out what that collaboration with Verily and Sanofi ever did, or what AbbVie did with Calico, or what is happening with... And, it's interesting when you do these analyses that there's press release for its launch, there's people talking about it in keynotes, and then you hear nothing ever again. And I just wondered if you know, within what you're doing, where you've got really interested, obviously clever and motivated people to come and take part in this community, how you break free of that kind of echo chamber and actually, you know, make sure you can drill and focus on things that actually are happening with patients or that actually improving clinical outcomes or, you know, kind of, you know what, I think you know what I'm saying. So I would, to stop rambling, I'll just say whoever wants to take that, I'd be really interested to hear what they think.
I have a comment if Daniel or David want to say something, but I think as we move to the digital age, really, we just need to consider, you know, making people aware. I think we can get to that equality. We can get to the products that need to be brought to patients if people are aware of what the data is, what the value of it. And really, you know, we build products and services from that. I've been on the conference circuit for quite a while, and I see a lot of conversations happen that, like you said, go absolutely nowhere. And as a patient in the lupus space and the rare disease space, there are innovations that need to happen. And so I think that it's through conversation, it's through gathering the insights of the communities that we're working with and really just bonding together with the people that really have that same mission and value and drive together. And so, I don't know, David, do you wanna take it from here?
I'll just do a quick input there, this is Daniel. I think while it's always exciting to have emerging technologies or the convergence of exponential trends, like, you know, a glucose sensor and a contact lens, and it's you know, sometimes fun and inspiring to mention those things, whether it's a press release or a keynote. Sometimes those don't always match with what are true unmet needs of a let's say a diabetic patient. I mean, that was a clever integration of technology, but probably not the best way to measure glucose when there's lots of other lower cost and less complicated ways of doing it. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking to better, faster, cheaper, and sometimes more integrated ways of doing things. It might be super convenient to have a contact lens like that in the future as one example, but it does come down to really understanding the unmet need from the patient perspective, from the family member, from the pharma and the payer and regular perspective, because sometimes these things don't really match. You build the people, but people don't come because of misaligned incentives, even when they might be superior technologies. But a key thing, as was just discussed, need to have the, you know, hashtag patient included in the loop to help inform what really is an unmet need and whether your new tech solution is just, you know, a shiny bright object or can really meet the need in the current form or in the future.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think that was my point, really. You just better articulated it. Dave, did you want to say anything, or do you think it's been said?
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to pick up on a few of the threads and the role that communication plays in that. You know, the thing that's come a lot through the opt-in and what Kelly, Aurora, and Pamela do, and for me, it's one of the best half an hour of the week, is it comes down to, you know, almost like control and a sense of equality control. So there's a real like equal component to it. And when you start to hear, you know, Daniel talk about scientific discoveries and you listen to Christine and the patient point of view, everyone really is getting or seeking a sense of control over their health and a sense of empowerment, and that coming through education. And that idea of health control has really emerged from the discussions as an area of focus. And it doesn't matter whether you're an individual, a family member, whether you're a patient, whether you're a healthcare professional, it's having that sense of control over your own health. And with that empowerment, you know, hopefully driving better outcomes. And that's definitely the focus for the event on September the 10th, and looking at how we can unlock some of these incredible scientific discoveries by helping to support and educate people by building trust and understanding in order to be able to deliver health control.
Yeah, no, that absolutely makes sense. And I think, I suppose, as a final perspective from me, I suppose there needs to be some kind of level of truth, doesn't there, to what we communicate and how we communicate this. Because I think that's the amazing thing about Silicon Valley, or about, you know, outside of Silicon Valley, any kind of entrepreneurs or technologists or healthcare professionals that are working on this, is it's about, you know, communicating the reality of what they're trying to achieve, what problems they're going to solve. Because people will attribute something to a company when it's nothing to do with them in order to make it sound like it's a more impressive thing. I don't know whether you saw the wellness at work thing that went around LinkedIn, which was supposedly Google's policy on wellness at work, which didn't match up to what I've heard from people at work at Google. And it turns out it was nothing to do with them. It was a 2016 UK government initiative. But these things get picked up because it sounds good if you say Google are doing this or Apple are involved in that. But yeah, it's true.
And that's what I think has been the best thing about this, really. It's been hearing from those people you wouldn't otherwise hear from. So Kelly and Aurora on a Monday to tell a story, and Kelly talks about she's only ever seen doctors that look like her. And Aurora turns around and says, I never have that. And what it gives you, which this industry is massively missing, is unbelievable context and unbelievable like insight into, you know, all these different perspectives. And I think if you've got that empathy and you've got that context, and I mean real context, it allows you to build the trust that you've just been describing, Alex.
Yeah.
And I think as an industry, we're sort of prioritized like volume and frequency. And actually, if you do the trust, then you start to be able to drive education. And education drives behavior change. And that, I think, unlocks the benefit of what Daniel was talking about at the start of the session.
Agreed. And I'm not going to try and top that with regard to a summary of what we've spoken about. But obviously, if there's anything anyone else would want to say before we kind of call a close, and I'll let you tell people how to get involved in Clubhouse, then, you know, raise your hand and go for it.
So I was just going to say that for anyone that wants to tune in, it is an amazing show, and we have the perspectives brought in from people all over industry. We even had Jamie Haywood from Patients Like Me coming in to talk about, you know, his effect on the patient communities. And so we're really trying to bridge that gap and really trying to fill in the lines and connect the dots so that patients like me can find their way through this healthcare system. But appreciate you for having us on, and really look forward to the conversations we're gonna have. And if anyone's interested, I'm always on 10 minutes early in the morning just to have casual conversation and get to know people. So I'll see you guys on Clubhouse.
Great. Well, thank you all for coming on. And Daniel, a special thanks for taking the such time at the beginning to give us your, you know, renowned expertise, which was really interesting. So it's very much appreciated. Dave, do you want to just say then, just, you know, a couple of seconds on, if for people maybe that don't know about Clubhouse, I've never done it, or don't know how to find what you do, what just practically what they do?
Yeah, no problem at all. So it's the same time every day, weekday, 10 a.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Central European time on Clubhouse. Search for Health Reconsidered. There's about 2,000 people who are members now, built over just a couple of months, which is exciting. But we also know that people can't come every day. You've got meetings, you've got lives to lead. So we've added a monthly wrap-up. So the first one was in August. I think there was, again, a couple of thousand people registered. 250 people turned up, which is not bad for the holiday season. And the next meeting is on September the 10th. So 10 a.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Central European, 4 p.m. Central European time on Zoom. And we've got incredible guests. We've got Daniel Kraft, who's coming back, super excited. He's going to be debating with Professor Shafi Ahmed, one of the most respected and reputed surgeons in the world. Jay Metcalf, founder of Wired Magazine, and Jason Sperling from Facebook Reality Lab. So incredible panel. Plus the rest of the regulars from Health Reconsidered debating how we deliver health control and improve outcomes.
Cool. Well, thank you very much. So on that, then I'll thank everyone for coming. Thank you, you know, more importantly, for those listening. As always, if you want to reach out with any comments to us, please do so. But other than that, thank you very much for continuing to listen, and we'll be speaking to you again soon.
Thanks.
Cheers, guys. That was nice.
Cool. Cheers. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.